Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Hey, hey, and welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I am so glad that you're choosing to spend part of your weekend with us, where we are going to look at news and look at the world itself through the lens of what if we put kids first. This is the radio show where we try to center the child in a lot of these different conversations, whether it's cultural or political. We want to make sure that we are elevating the rights and well-being of children because that is what justice requires. Justice requires that we, the adults, do hard things on behalf of kids because the only alternative is for kids to do hard things on behalf of adults, and that is an injustice. And we are going to start out with a little bit of Bible time. As always, I've got with me Patience Sunny, my engagement director, and she's actually been reading through the book of Job. One of the things that I love about Job is obviously this poor man's got to give a defense over and over and over for why, no, really, I'm not being punished here, I promise. I don't have some kind of secret sin I'm hiding. And I remember this passage where he talks about one of the reasons why he actually has been living virtuously. And one of the reasons that he gives is he was like a father to the fatherless. He extended his hands to, you know, the poor and needy. And that is true, right? That is something that all of us, if we consider ourselves to be followers of God, that we need to be looking out for the poor, the vulnerable, the marginalized, especially when it's kids. Now, Job as a whole kind of makes me angry. I'm like, are you kidding me? I need to, if I was to tell you what I think the book of Job is, especially in the election season, what it is a lot of misinformation and disinformation. That's what's going on. Like half the chapters are just like people that are spewing information that distorts, gets things a little bit wrong. Why? Because they are really driving at their own ideological agenda here. But Patience, in her reading this week, really saw a connection as it relates to ultimately how we need to be thinking about what our posture should be in relation to a major change in governance in our country. So Patience, tell us what you feel like God was telling you this week when you were going through the book of Job.
Yeah, so I got to the end of the book of Job this week. Actually finished it right as I was watching election results coming in. And I love that Job is so honest. Job voices his complaint throughout the book, and in that way gives us words to pray when we are facing confusion and suffering. We have the words of Job in scripture that we can offer to God. But also we have God's answer to Job. In Job 38, the Lord answers Job from the whirlwind after Elihu has rebuked both Job and his friends for speaking wrongly about God. And God says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" God points Job to the world that he has made and says, "You don't have control over this. You don't command the earth the way that I do. You don't have all of this control that you like to think that you have." And, you know, Job's ultimate reply after a couple chapters of God pointing Job to his might and his splendor, Job says, "I place my hand over my mouth." Job recognizes, I do not have the right to tell God what he ought to do. And that reminder of God's control was really encouraging. You know, facing a change in our nation that, you know, maybe it's going to be good. Maybe it's going to have some concerns from a pro-life, pro-child perspective. It's that reminder that, you know, we don't get to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, look, we did this, we're in control. And we also don't need to say, oh, no, what's going to happen? We're in control, because we're not. God is. And the God who speaks from the whirlwind to Job and commands the depths of the sea and has created this incredible world that we, you know, we cannot control nature. And he has said, I'm in control of this.
Yeah, it's exactly right to be able to position God where he belongs, which is at the top. And what that means is we can trust him. He is in control, but that doesn't mean that we are free of obligation and responsibility. Because God is in control, because we can trust him, we also are called to engage on his behalf, to be agents of reconciliation and righteousness in our personal capacity, but also in matters of public policy as well. And one of the first stories that I want to talk about today is this report from the Institute of Family Studies that shows how knowing people in healthy, committed marriages makes it easier to have a healthy, committed marriage. So I'm going to have you summarize this, Patience, and then I think that there's some pretty fantastic applications for those of us that are concerned about the state of the world. What is it that we can do to strengthen and fortify all of the people around us, even if they're not directly in our family? So give me a recap, Patience, on what it is that the Institute of Family Studies found as it relates to just having married couples in your lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they found a decline in voluntary relationships at all levels, marriage, church, personal friendships, that it takes a serious toll on the quality of life in society. So the article looks at a range of different kinds of relationships that matter in a life, in a person's life, and how that affects economic mobility, overall stability, life satisfaction. But one of the things that I found particularly striking is Chris Bullivant says the share of married parents in a child's neighborhood is the biggest indicator of whether that child will escape poverty, while other academics have observed that neighborhoods with high rates of single parenthood experience more crime and violence than neighborhoods with a greater proportion of two-parent families. So even just being around families that have stable two-parent marriages really makes a difference in the lives of kids. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind from a pro-child perspective, is the way that forming a strong family not only impacts your own kids, but impacts the kids in your neighborhood, impacts the people around you.
Yeah. You know, we talk about in our second book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, that one of the biggest part of worldview transmission is you become what you behold. Mm-hmm. And if you are beholding your own parents in a loving, joyous, stable marriage, it is much more easy to become somebody that creates and maintains that kind of marriage yourself. If you behold your mother or father with a genuine relationship with Christ and able to engage and defend your Christian worldview, it's much easier for the child to become somebody who can have a genuine relationship and engage and do battle on behalf of a biblical worldview. But if you grow up in a home where you only have a single mom, or your parents are divorced and you're splitting time between the two of them, there is a lot of power in beholding another couple who is working things out, keeping their marriage together, delighting in one another. And that is something that your marriage, your family, you modeling beauty, goodness, friendship in your relationship, it is going to have massive positive impacts, not just for your kids, but for the other kids that are watching. And there's a lot of kids who are watching. And I know this because I was one of those kids. You know, my parents divorced when I was 10, and I did have one friend whose parents were married and really liked each other. And I would watch them. I'd be fascinated at the way that they interacted with each other. And I remember they would do things like, no sleepovers on Friday night. That's family game night. And I thought, you're just going to be with your family on Friday and you're all going to enjoy one another together. I thought that's so bizarre and strange because my parents were kind of off with their new families. And so my world was a little more fragmented than it was before. And it just opened my eyes that there was a whole nother way to do this. So it turns out that this is actually a solution against poverty, that having a lot of married couples, stably married couples in a neighborhood actually can compensate in a lot of ways for a child who's missing out on what's going on in their home. That's not to say that, you know, this is the be-all, end-all solution. Unfortunately, it's not. That child is still going to struggle with significant challenges, as we regularly discuss at Them Before Us. But you simply being a present, connected witness. And you know, my recommendation is always to pull those kids into your lives a little bit more. You know, if you're noticing that they're sort of lingering, invite them to stay for dinner. Let them feast on what a healthy family dynamic looks like. Patients, we just have a little more time, but do you have thoughts on that, on the importance of kind of allowing kids to see your lives, even if they maybe don't have the ideal in their own home?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's something that, you know, I saw growing up in a family that did foster care, where, you know, kids from broken families had the opportunity to be in a home where there was that stability. And I remember one foster brother in particular, he had never had a father figure before staying with my family. And the way that he just adored my dad was so striking. And I was really young when he lived with us, but I remember just the way that he loved my dad. And it was because he'd never had that in his life before. And being able to bring that into a child's life, that was such a blessing to them. And it was a blessing to me growing up to see the reason that that matters. You know, being in a pretty stable family situation, I didn't have the experience of this is broken, I need it fixed. But I did have the experience of somebody can come in and offer something to someone in a broken situation. And that's an incredible ministry opportunity as well. So that was a huge part of my growing up. And honestly, a huge part of what brought me to Them Before Us was seeing the difference that adults who do hard things on behalf of kids can make in the lives, not just of their own kids, but also in the lives of other children that they touch.
Yeah. We're going to spend some time, especially in the next segment, talking about adoption. And adoption is, you know, at Them Before Us, we talk about why adoption is redemptive, but it begins with loss. You know, adoption is not a zero-sum game for kids. It begins with loss. It's something that I think we can and should acknowledge. But we spend a lot of time at Them Before Us talking about policy, talking about trending news, and all of that matters. Like, politics matter because people matter. And all of these different ballot initiatives that we discussed last week, they really are going to have very real impacts on the lives of children. And so it's important for us to speak up and be highly engaged on political issues. It's not a dirty business. It is a biblical business to be engaged in politics. But we have to go far, far beyond that if we really are going to be who we need to be who God expects us to be in the world. Yes, engage. Yes, articulate a biblical position on a lot of these different policies. But there's so much power in simply doing the basics. You know, I mean, think about Jeremiah talking to the exiles. Get married, have a home, raise kids, find wives and husbands for them, raise grandchildren, have a garden, right? Some of the most ordinary things today are the most powerful things today, especially when you allow the kids in your world who don't have it to behold you living out those biblical principles so they can become that person in the future. Stay with us. We'll be back with segment two.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to defend children's right to their mother and father. And that makes us opponents of things like sperm and egg donation. It makes us opponents of things like surrogacy, which always denies children a relationship with their birth mother. It makes us opponents of easy divorce. It makes us critics of modern families where children have to lose their mother or father to be in that family. It makes us strong supporters of natural marriage, because that's the only institution that unites the two people to whom children have a natural right. And that also makes us fierce advocates for adoption when you properly understand what adoption is and who it's for. So we're going to have a bit of a focus today on adoption. And to help me with this, we've got my engagement director, Patience Sunny, here. We're going to kick off this segment with a somewhat disturbing news item about a woman who was selling her baby on Facebook. And then we're going to discuss, like, is that adoption? What is that? Like, if that's not okay, is any kind of adoption okay? So, Patience, give us a rundown of what this mother in Texas was arrested for.
Yeah, so this young woman in Texas, 21-year-old Juniper Bryson, had made arrangements with multiple couples that she'd reached out to on Facebook. She posted in a group of hopeful parents looking to adopt. She said, hey, I'm looking for an adoptive parent for my child. But then she started demanding money. She was asking for $150 upfront. So, it, you know, appalling that she's selling her baby, even more appalling that she considers her child to be worth $150. But what ultimately happened was she had made arrangements with one adoptive parent who had already signed the adoption papers with no discussion of money. And then that parent, Wendy Williams, started receiving messages from people that Bryson had also contacted. And it became clear that her intention had been to give her baby to the highest bidder. And when she was confronted, she asked Williams to leave, and eventually the police were called in. They investigated this. They found that she had been asking for money from multiple couples with the intention of making the most amount possible off of selling her baby. So really an appalling injustice against that child, that the mother would treat her baby as something to be sold rather than someone to be loved and cherished.
So very interesting, because when she was confronted, the mom said, well, isn't this just like surrogacy? And the truth is, she's really not that wrong about it. In adoption, there are prohibitions against accepting payment for the baby. But big fertility in the world of IVF, sperm and egg donation, and especially surrogacy, that whole industry is built upon direct payments to the birth parents, to the genetic parents, in exchange for the child. So let's spend a little time talking about what is the difference between adoption and these reproductive technologies. And let's just begin first by identifying real child-centric adoption, because there are certainly abuses that can happen within the adoption world. But adoption best practice at the international, the national, and the state level has safeguards in place to try to preserve and protect the best interest of the child. That's always the guiding light when we are talking about what adoption is for and who adoption is for. So, Patience, do you want to just give us a bit of a rundown? I mean, you understand this from a policy perspective, but you also have several adopted siblings. So tell us what adoption is, especially from a biblical child-centric perspective.
Yeah, so, you know, from a policy perspective, it's radically different from surrogacy. Like you said, you know, there are regulations in place making it very clear you do not accept money in exchange for children, because adoption is fundamentally a child-centric institution. It's not about the adults involved. The purpose of adoption is to provide a child that has faced the loss of their parents, whatever the circumstances that led to that loss. They've experienced that loss, and adoption is there to provide a safe and loving family for them where they can receive healing from those past wounds, and they can be nurtured, be loved, have parents who are raising them. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind with adoption. In adoption, the child is a client. And, you know, you've said elsewhere, Katie, adoption exists to give a family to every child who needs one, not a child to every adult who wants one. And that framing is really important in understanding the purpose of adoption, what it's for, and ultimately who it's for. It's for the children involved.
Yeah, I think that because we on the right, you know, I certainly lean right. I think a lot of the audience probably does too. A lot of us Christians, we understand that adoption is redemptive. But adoption begins with loss. And I have talked about some of the challenges of adoption, both as an adoptive mom and as somebody who was the former assistant director of the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world. That adoption begins with loss for kids. Sometimes it's a loss that they don't ever fully get over, and that an adoptive family can seek to mend that wound, but sometimes that wound runs so deep. And so we need to be very careful. We should never be casual about any kind of process that separates children from their parents. Now, I think that we have run into a bit of an error on the side of those of us who are staunchly pro-life, where we do, if I personally know that when I start to talk about some of the challenges of adoption from the perspective of the child in terms of seeking to heal from the relinquishment or the struggle that they have to bond and attach, there are some responses from the right, from pro-lifers, even from Christians that say, don't talk about that. You can't talk about that. Because if you talk about any possible downside of adoption, you'll drive people to abortion. And I think that that is a very short-sighted way to look at this. Number one, because I don't think that adoption is the primary solution to an unplanned pregnancy. I think parenting is the solution to an unplanned pregnancy. And if the birth mother and or birth father can't or will not care for a child, then adoption is the best option. But second, I think that it does both adoptive parents and adopted children a disservice when we pretend like adoption fixes everything. Because then when one or both are struggling, they may think that there's something wrong with them, when the reality is there isn't. No child should be forced to sever the connection with their first family and reattach to biological strangers. You are working outside of the system that God designed for continuous trust and attachment, for identity formation. Sometimes that needs to take place because tragedy has occurred or because the birth family really is not in a position to raise the child. And in those situations, that's exactly why we have adoption. But we also need to be honest about the cost that it inflicts on kids and the struggles that can result. So patients, give us a little information, just kind of an adoption survey. Like, where are we at in this country? How many people are adopting? What does that look like?
Yeah. So around 5 million Americans were adopted. 2 to 4% of American families have adopted. About a third have considered adopting. So significant disparity between the number of people who have considered it and the people who have actually done it. But according to the Congressional Council on Adoption Institute, there are over 113,000 children waiting to be adopted in the U.S., and the average child will wait 3 years for an adoptive family in the United States, with about 53,500 children and youth being adopted per year. And an important thing to be aware of with adoption in the United States, like you were saying, Katie, where these are kids who have experienced loss, and that you can't just expect it to be, everything is fixed simply because they've been placed in a family. 29% of the kids who were adopted in the U.S. were 9 or older. The average age for adoption is 6 years old. So these are kids who have faced significant trauma in their early lives, who have missed out on some of that important bonding in those early years. And, that is a challenge that adoptive families need to navigate. And they need to have people alongside them, supporting them, telling them, no, you're not crazy, you're not doing it wrong, just because your child is facing some of these challenges, but that your child is grieving real loss and experiencing real trauma. And that doesn't make adoption a bad thing. Adoption is how we bring redemption to those situations. But also we do need to have the sensitivity to acknowledge that those are difficult situations, and that it's unfair to expect the child to just automatically stop feeling some of those feelings of abandonment and loss that they may be experiencing, especially because, a high percentage of adopted kids in the U.S. are adopted out of foster care. So these are kids who have lived in multiple homes, have had a number of different caregivers who do not have the title of mom or dad, and may be coming from a situation where their first family was abusive or neglectful. And there are a lot of complicated pieces at play for those kids. And, a lot of things for adoptive parents and families to be thinking about as they're navigating those and as they're bringing the love of Christ into that situation.
So it's interesting because at Them Before Us, our board, I think we've got between all of the different board members, we probably have 15 adopted kids and maybe 5 biological kids, right? Among all of us, there's many, many more adopted children than there are biological children. And no surprise, the people that are on my board are highly committed Christians. And that is pretty, it reflects pretty accurately the fact that Christians are more likely to adopt than the average man and woman on the street. So tell us a little more about the profile of people who are more likely to adopt. Why is it that adoption is connected to a biblical worldview very often?
Yeah. So, Christians are twice as likely to adopt as the general population. And I think part of that is that scripture makes it very clear that adoption is a picture of the relationship that God has with us. And that as Christians, we are called to care for the orphan. We are called to care for the fatherless. And so I think that part of that is Christians who are acting on biblical convictions. I think another piece of it, kind of going back to what we talked about in the first segment, is that social support factor. Christians who are in committed churches have a greater degree of social support than someone who doesn't have that in their life in a lot of cases, which makes it easier for those families to navigate adoption. And also, you're more likely, if Christians are twice as likely to adopt, you're more likely to know someone who has walked that journey and who has walked that journey from a similar biblical worldview to yours.
Yeah, so it is noble. And I don't necessarily think, though, that every Christian needs to adopt. I think every Christian needs to ask God if they should adopt. But adoption is not for everybody. Not everybody is called to adopt. And it's really important for us as adults and as Christians specifically, we always need to approach adoption from the perspective of, I am seeking to mend the wounds of this child. This is not primarily about completing my family or seeking to have a child, even though I'm experiencing infertility. Adoption is, and always must be, primarily considered around what the child needs. So it's very good for Christians to seek to extend that love and care for the fatherless by grafting them into our home. Patients, give us just very, very briefly, some states are making this harder on Christians. So what is going on in the world of adoption where it really looks like there is state power that is working to stymie Christians specifically who want to adopt?
Yeah, so Alliance Defending Freedom is actually currently defending a woman in Oregon who's been blocked from adopting because she won't affirm the state's radical gender ideology. And this is something that Christians are starting to see in the realm of foster care and adoption is hostility on the county and state level towards their beliefs and an unwillingness from state and county officials to place children with people who hold to a biblical view of marriage. And this was actually a similar case went through the Supreme Court back in 2020-2021, where Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia lost their contract with the city because they would not affirm same-sex marriage. And what Catholic Social Services was doing was they were basically helping the city place kids in families. They were providing that extra step and that extra support so that there were foster families available in Philadelphia through the Catholic Social Services Network. And the court ruled in favor of Catholic Social Services, but you know, we're seeing in Oregon and in other places that hostility towards Christian beliefs, which really matters in the realm of pro-family advocates, because people should never be in a position where they have to choose between speaking up for the best interest of kids and being able to put those beliefs in action and welcome a vulnerable child into their home.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane to me that when you've got especially foster kids in desperate situations that need homes, that you would limit the adoption pool by cutting out the population twice as likely to adopt as the rest. Talk about one way where we need to bring a child-centric perspective back into an issue. Patients, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to head now to your questions, largely adoption-related. Stay with us.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
We're back at Them Before Us Radio. I am so glad that you're giving us part of your weekend. And we are going to kind of continue with the adoption theme in our Q&A segment. We've got some really good questions from some of our followers. And this is an important topic because adoption is redemptive. Adoption is a way for us to seek to mend something that was lost, something that was broken in a child's life. But we also want to make sure that we do it with care and that we do it with virtue and godliness and with the child at the center of all of the different decisions and considerations. So that's what we're going to address with a couple of the listener Q&A. And Jen is going to pitch us some of the questions that you've sent in over the week related to adoption.
Hi, Katie. Hi, everybody. This is a really good question because I think it pretty much applies to all of us, no matter what setting we live in or even where we land on the religious or ideological spectrum. But one person asked, how should we go about trying to love and care for our neighbors when all our kids want to play together, when we have such big ideological differences from them?
Oh, okay. Yes. This is a very good question. And I think that the main issue is not how different are your views. The main issue is, are your neighbors trying to evangelize your children into a worldview that is anti-reality, anti-God, and ultimately destructive? So I think that it's really good for kids to play with and hang out with people who, especially if they're neighborhood kids, my gosh, if you've got a little tribe that your kids can run around with outside, you are blessed. And if that means that they're coming from a different background, maybe they even have a different family structure, they have different ideas about the world, that's okay. I think it's great for kids to grow up and then maybe it's not until they're 12 and they realize, oh, Mr. and Mrs., you know, Davis, they don't agree with us about anything, but wow, we love them and we love their kids, right? That's an awesome conclusion to come to. The challenge is if Mr. and Mrs. Davis, every time your kid is over there sitting down having snacks, is saying things like, I can't believe that people believe in that, you know, sky god fairy. And, you know, it's absolutely anti-science nonsense. Or if Mr. and Mrs. Davis are saying things like, you know, it's really important that we use preferred pronouns or whatever it is. And so especially when your kids are under the age of 10, I think it's important to filter out the distortions in their world. Like, that is the time when you should saturate them in the good, true, and beautiful. If they're interacting with people that disagree, that's fine. But if they have somebody in their life, a neighbor, a teacher, or maybe even extended family that are actively seeking to evangelize and disciple your children into a different worldview, that is where you need to have a conversation. That's where you need to go next door and say, hi, Mrs. Davis. I am so glad the kids love hanging out together and climbing trees together. And I'm so thankful that you guys are next door. I think that we have some really significant worldview differences. Can we just make an agreement to not necessarily talk about that with each other's kids? Maybe once they're in middle school, we could do some kind of introduction, worldview introduction, like what do the Davises think or what do the Fausts think or something like that. And a lot of parents are like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense to me. But if they say, no, this is who we are, and I'm sorry if your kid's a bigot and you're a bigot, but we're not going to hold back on what we believe. That's at the point where you might need to go, okay, we might need to limit some of the playtime, or simply say, you guys can go out and hang out and play. I don't necessarily want you around the adults, or I don't want you at their house. You guys can hang out at our house. Hopefully it won't come to that though, because honestly, we need more playtime. Bring back neighborhood play. Jen, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, thinking about it from adult to adult perspective, I remember playing volleyball with like adult women's team. I think I was a sub, so it wasn't people I knew well. And I remember at some level realizing, I think I was like 21, and realizing that like some of these women were gay, like their partner showed up with their child. And that, so I'm in this setting as homeschooled Christian kid. I'd had exposure to different kinds of people and families because I went to public community college and things like that. But I had this really deep concern that this, if they were going to just stop and ask me, oh, what do you think about this? Oh, you're a Christian, so you hate me. I thought there was going to be some sort of like antagonistic thing toward me, especially if they figured out I was a Christian. And I remember feeling a sense from God that sort of just build as much positive rapport with these gals that you know, I only knew them a handful of weeks, while you can. Just be the kindest, hardest working person on the team, super gracious to the partner, kind to the little kid, friendly, and get along with everyone as much as possible until they find out you're a Christian. You know, eventually someone asked me what I did for work, and I worked for a Christian organization. And it was just great conversations. And there, that moment never came, but I would have been really fearful of, oh, they're going to ask me. Most people don't actually go around and the first thing they want to know is like, what do you personally think about these decisions I make, or you know, my political decisions over here. I think typical people just kind of get along until you give them a reason not to get along. And it's okay to just be friendly and kind. And then when they learn you're a Christian or a conservative, I had this with a friend who we disagree politically. She could not get her head around who I was as a person and that I disagreed with her politically. And I was saying, that is your problem. That's your bad view of what you think people who vote differently from you are. You know, I love you and I'm a kind person, but you thought everyone who disagrees with you is horrible. So now your mind is getting, you know, needs to get fixed. Okay, for our next question, this gal is saying, my friends want to adopt a child from another country. They don't feel concerned at all about the ethnic and cultural differences that their child would experience in their new family and setting. Should we care about that at all, or is that being woke?
Yeah. So you should acknowledge that there is an aspect of this that creates a distinct challenge for the child. Is that a reason to not adopt the child? No. I mean, especially if, you know, my context for this is Chinese adoption, and I have got friends that have adopted special needs kids from Europe. And a lot of these kids really did not have other options. There are some situations where there are other options for kids. I mean, a lot of the African adoptions that took place over the last couple of years, we now learned that those were not necessarily kids that needed to be adopted. They were kids that needed temporary care while their parents were able to figure things out. But there are a lot of kids that are overseas where there is no hope for them to be reunited with their family. And there isn't an option for them to be adopted by somebody in country, which I would say would be the next best thing beyond being adopted by a relative. And so I would say, no, that's not enough to say don't adopt. But that's not to say that it means nothing. You know, those ethnic differences, they can pose challenges for kids. I think that the Korean adoptees did a good job of kind of talking about how it was hard for them. Many of them kind of went to totally white communities and were loved, so loved, but really felt like, I am not like anybody else that is here. And so it's important for parents to have some awareness that, yeah, you know what, identity formation does include kind of integrating your race. And it's something to be aware of and to acknowledge. For some kids, it's a bigger deal than it is for other kids. So it's not nothing, but it's certainly not everything. And rescuing the child out of a situation, especially if they're older or have a special need and really need medical care, that is the biggest priority. But to think that that's all that needs to be done is probably short-sighted. You probably also need to go into this going, okay, I need to understand that, you know, this child that I'm bringing in who is Asian or Black, they are going to have some distinct questions, maybe some distinct struggles because they don't look like everybody else in our family or anybody else in our community.
I think there's the two sides of this pendulum that maybe the progressive left has swung so far to saying it's everything. It's so important that white parents should not adopt, right? And that's just this crazy over swinging in one direction. But swinging the other direction, and I had this conversation with Delana Squires on our Them Before Us podcast, because he wrote our chapter about race in pro-child politics. We talked about conservatives can swing too far to the other side. And in saying that the only things that matter are equal opportunity, that we kind of want to dismiss any conversation about difference or culture or ethnicity, when it seems like the reality should be, especially for Christians, acknowledging that God made unique looks and cultures, and there's beautiful differences. And it is dismissing to someone who looks or maybe feels different, or they're not part of the dominant culture, for people in the dominant culture to say, that doesn't matter, or I'm colorblind. Because you're in essence saying, I don't really see a part of you that is important. It's not the most essential part of someone, but it's an important part of them. And most people in the dominant culture rarely have to be the only person who looks like them, right? So I think those kinds of things are really good for adoptive parents to consider and be aware of. And the same way you've talked about parents being very open to their children's grief about losing their parents. I'm so sorry that happened. I wish that had not happened for you. I wish I had those answers for you, and I don't. I think parents can do their kids a service by being open when it comes to those things. Trying to see, is your child feeling, you know, I feel it's hard for me that I'm the only one who looks like us in our looks like me in our family photo. I think that can go a long way if parents engage with that sort of thing.
Yeah, agree.
Okay. Another question about adoption. This was from a gal who's a new follower of ours, and she was very supportive, but she has taken some issue with how we've talked about adoption and the birth mothers, because we talk about surrogacy as kind of trading. You get money and you give away your baby. And she was saying, in her take, that is happening with birth mothers. That is happening with adoption. She pointed to Florida and Ohio and said, look, if they need help, financial assistance, they can get up to $10,000, $4,000. How is that not the same thing as buying women's babies. So how would we answer that from the TBU perspective?
Yeah, so the distinction that we make between adoption and surrogacy is in adoption, money is never permitted to go from the intended parents to the birth mother in exchange for relinquishing the child. But in surrogacy, the whole system is built on paying the surrogate to relinquish her parental rights and hand over the child. And so that's trafficking, right? Anytime money's going from the intended parents to the birth or genetic parents, that's a violation of adoption best practice. So I totally understand what this woman is asking. It's a very, very good question. And there are reimbursement options for birth mothers in a variety of different states. Sometimes they are substantial and sometimes they can be abused. So I think that she's right to put her finger on that. Not only that, but sometimes birth mothers are coerced in some ways, you know, or pressured, sometimes financially, to relinquish their child. And those are things that really need to be identified, tackled, and corrected. But even then, that is not the same thing. A reimbursement, even if it's abused, is not the same thing as directly paying a woman to relinquish her child. So I do think that we need to support birth mothers in general, right? A better way to do this is a lot of the birth mothers, especially young, unplanned pregnancy situations, they need help. Like, we need to support birth mothers, whether they keep or whether they relinquish their child, right? They need help, maybe financially, definitely emotionally. Maybe there's other ways that we can support them as they walk through the pregnancy, regardless of what they end up choosing in the end. But yeah, there's a very sticky place when especially adoption agencies with newborn children are dangling a carrot of financial support in exchange for relinquishing the child. So even though there, I would say, just because there's a danger of abuse in that situation, which there can be sometimes, it is still not the same as the direct payments to a woman to hand over her child in big fertility.
Yeah. It reminded me of the Facebook post of a woman trying to sell her baby. And you made the comment on Twitter. Well, she said to police or whoever, she said, wait, I thought that was allowed because that's what surrogacy and these things are doing.
So yeah, there was a Texas case of a woman who was trying to sell her newborn and she was arrested. She's like, well, I thought it was just like surrogacy. And I'm like, well, that's right. I mean, it is like and if she had a properly signed contract, that's what it would have been. So like, yeah, like there's a lot of confusion about it.
Yeah. So it just shows there's confusion. It's kind of the same as the abortion law things that people are trying. When you want to use it to go a certain way, then you're going to justify different things. And so women that want to abuse these systems and try to sell their adopt out their children or sell them on Facebook. But ultimately that's not the case.
Yeah. And there's certainly intended parents and adoption agencies that I think are putting financial pressure on women to relinquish their kids. And that's something that needs to be confronted, condemned, because that's, you know, if a woman wants to keep her baby, that is the number one best option. The solution to an unplanned pregnancy is not first adoption, it's parenting. And we want to support those women in that endeavor. Thanks for joining us this week, and we will see you here same time, same place next weekend.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.